October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month, held each year to commemorate the many contributions of people with disabilities to America's workplaces and economy. The University of Hartford Disability Affinity Network sponsors a month-long campaign during National Disability Employment Awareness Month, focusing on weekly topics through strategic University Daily email U-Notes postings. The Affinity Network has drawn attention to acceptance and inclusion, universal design for learning, employment-related resources, with one focus on the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. Today, I'm honored to talk with Tony Coelho, the primary author of the ADA legislation and a former congressman. Tony joins me today from California. Tony, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Abe. It's good to be with you.
Tony, let's start at the very beginning of your personal journey. I know you yourself struggled to deal with disability. As a teenager, you were diagnosed with epilepsy. How were you able to deal with this disability as a young man?
Well, Abe, it started off with me having an accident on the dairy farm, and I didn't have a seizure until a year later, and I had a grand mal seizure. My brother carried me in from the barn where we were milking into the house. Doctor came out, and the doctor told my parents that he thought it was a seizure, meaning that he felt it was probably epilepsy. My family rejected that because, being Portuguese and firm Catholics, they were taught that if you have epilepsy, that you're possessed by the devil, and that it was because of some major sin somebody in the family had committed, and God was punishing the family through an individual. And so they went to other doctors to make sure that it was something else. And we went to about three other doctors. All those doctors said, told them it was epilepsy. Didn't tell me, because in those days you didn't talk to the patient, you talked to parents and so forth. And so my parents said, well, it's a lack of calcium, it's this or that. And I never knew the truth. Then we went to witch doctors. We went to three witch doctors who guaranteed that they'd get rid of the evil spirits. After the third one, I said I wouldn't go anymore, and that caused problems with my family. Then I just continued having these, I called them passing out spells, not knowing what they were, but, you know, I would pass out, and once I recovered, I could go ahead, and I was tired, but I could go ahead and work or do whatever had to be done. I then went to Loyola University in Los Angeles, being taught by the Jesuits, Catholic order of the church. And I continued having my seizures. I was very impressed with these Jesuits. I went to a small public high school, but I was now exposed to a great deal of just information I never had before. Mm-hmm. I kept having my seizures, and that wasn't a problem. Kennedy gets assassinated in 63. I decide as a result of that, that I'm not sure I really want to continue pursuing a legal career. I wanted to be a trial lawyer, impacted by To Kill a Mockingbird, to be honest. But then after a lot of thought, I decided that I want to become a Catholic priest, become a Jesuit. And that was to the shock of my girlfriend and my fraternity brothers. But that's what I wanted. And so when I graduated from college, I was student body president, outstanding senior, and the Jesuits made a big issue of that I was joining the Jesuits. I went for my physical, and the doctor said, after all kinds of tests, have you ever heard the word epilepsy? I said, no. And he said, well, it's what you have. And there's good news and bad news. The good news is you're 4F and you can't serve in the military. This was right in the middle of Vietnam, 64. And he said, the bad news is that the Catholic Church, canon law, established in 400 AD, said that if you have epilepsy or possessed by the devil, you can't be a priest. Well, I walked out of there happy because I knew what my problem was, and he was going to prescribe medication to help ease the severity of the seizure, no cure, but the ease and severity of it. And to me, that was great. And I had gotten a lot of job offers and so forth. So I called my parents and say how happy I was that I knew what it was. They said, no son of ours has epilepsy. And that sort of broke a relationship I had in the family. I started going out for interviews for the jobs that people had presented to me. And I couldn't get an interview because on every job application was the word epilepsy. And of course, I wasn't going to lie. I checked it and I never even got an interview. So after a period of time, I knew that that's what was causing me not to have these interviews. And so I then started drinking a lot, and I was drunk by 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a hill. When you're drunk, you think it's a mountain, but on a hill in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. And I became suicidal because everything I'd ever wanted to do or loved in my life turned against me, meaning my church, God, in my view, my family. I couldn't get a job and so forth. And so I became suicidal. The day I was going to do the dirty deed, a voice came over me and said, you're going to be just like those little kids. There was a merry-go-round at the bottom of the hill. You're going to be just like those little kids. You're never going to let anybody or anything stop you from doing what you want to do. I don't know where that voice came from, but all of a sudden, I got my mojo back. Hmm. And I felt great. And I stopped drinking. And about a couple of weeks later, a Jesuit friend of mine said, I have an opportunity for you. And I was all excited. He said, I'm friends with some people who know the Bob Hope and family. And you can end up living with him and so forth. And I, of course, was excited about that because in 1964, Mr. Hope was a dominant figure in the entertainment world. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up living with him and ate my meals with him, had a room in the house with them, traveled with Mr. Hope at times and so forth. One day he said to me, Tony, your problem is that you think that you have a ministry and it only can be practiced in a church. Where you're mistaken is that a true ministry is practiced in sports, in entertainment, business, government, but you belong in politics. Now, nobody had ever told me that before. Now, I was student body president in high school and college and so forth, so I obviously loved politics, but I didn't think of partisan politics or anything like that. I started thinking about it. It was intriguing to me. And so I wrote a letter to my congressman who I didn't know. And I got a job and started working with him. And I worked with him for 13 years. I got to know government from that basis. And when he retired, I decided to run in his place. So that's sort of my background and how I ended up in Congress.
Hmm. I have to ask you, Tony, when I think of Bob Hope, I think of the entertainer and his many appearances, yeah, hosting the Academy Awards, the Oscars. What was life like in the Bob Hope household?
Oh, it was fun. I have to tell you. He had, of course, a great sense of humor, and it wasn't just on TV. It was in life. And so one time we had a dinner, and Martha Ray, who most of the people listening to this wouldn't know who she was, but she was a very famous comedian at the time, had a TV show and so forth and so on. And she'd been married 5 times, and she was over for dinner with her first husband. And so it was Mr. and Mrs. Hope, her and her husband, and their youngest son, Kelly, and myself. So in the midst of the dinner, they started talking, and they were making fun of a fellow comedian that was on the air that was very much in love with his wife on the air, but in fact, in reality, was not. And they just got up from the table and started acting out the part of the lovey-dovey stuff and then saying, but this. And Mrs. Hope actually fell to the ground laughing so hard I was laughing. And it was like that all the time. I mean, I can also remember that Lyndon Johnson was president and was concerned, you know, at that point where Mr. Hope was in regards to support, and wanted to make sure, knowing that he was a solid Republican and probably a friend of Goldwater's, he wanted to make sure he didn't endorse Goldwater. And so Johnson would call and he'd say, oh, my God, there he is again, just trying to keep me away from going. And, you know, we would laugh and so forth. And then he was very close to Goldwater. And he showed me a letter that Goldwater sent him. He didn't. I never knew of any phone calls, but I'm sure there were. But a letter that was just spectacular. And as a Democrat, I was very impressed with what Goldwater said. I ended up voting for Johnson because of my concern of a few issues. But it was that type of thing. You know, people, one other time I'll tell you quickly that he played every weekend. He brought in a golf pole, a pro from somewhere in the country, because he had three holes in his backyard, and have a lesson from this golf pro. And after the lesson, Kelly and I would join he and the golf pro for brunch. And so I got to meet all these guys. And one day Mr. Hope said, Tony, have you ever played golf? I said, no. He said, well, I'm going to get you some clubs and let's go out and play. I said, okay, you know, why not? But not too far into that little session, he said, I think you ought to pass on this. No, I never touched a golf club since that time. But anyhow, it was a ball, I'll tell you. He became like a father to me. He was just wonderful. And when I left, he said, I hope that you won't write anything about our experiences, your living. And I said, of course I won't. And so I took it to the nth degree. And so one day I'm in Modesto, my area, and there's a lot of Greeks in that area. And so they had an event, and I, you know, decided to go as a congressman, decided to go because a Greek had run against me the first time, and I lost the Greek vote the first time. And I decided, well, I got to court these people. So I go to this event, and Bob Hope is the guest. And so I'm sitting way in the back because I'm keeping my promise. I sit way in the back, and all of a sudden I get a tap on my shoulder, and this guy says, Mr. Hope knows you're here and he wants to talk to you. So I immediately get up and I go back to the green room, and I walk in and he says, what are you doing? And I said, what do you mean? He said, we haven't talked in such an X period of years. And I said, Mr. Hope, I promised you that I would never use our relationship in any way. He said, don't you think you're carrying it too far? And so we took some pictures, and then I saw him several times after that. But just a wonderful, wonderful human being, and his wife was the same.
Tony, how exactly was it, and I guess when was it, that you entered politics?
Well, after I wrote the letter to my congressman and I got the job, I loved it. I mean, I loved being a staffer, and he was the type of guy that was very involved in a lot of different things. We come from an agriculture area, so obviously he was on the agriculture committee. And he wanted me to help him on agriculture issues because his staff, there was nobody on there that was from agriculture. And so he wanted me to help. So my job was to be the agriculture person for him and also the file clerk. I was making $6,000 a year as a starting job, but I loved it. I loved everything about it. And you know, the genes are there, I guess. And so as the more I worked with him and he exposed me to a lot of different things and so forth, one day, and he became like my father, he and his wife became father and mother to me and to my wife, and our kids called him grandma and grandpa and so forth. And we went to every football game and baseball game with him and so forth. So one day when we're talking and we would spend the holidays with he and his wife, He said, look, when I retire, I would like you to take my place. Well, you know, I was excited, you know, yes. Now, it took him several years to decide to retire, but I was excited. And that's how I really got into the whole thing, realizing that this was a career opportunity all of a sudden. And so I worked with him, and he called me. Actually, he had a family meeting. He had two daughters, and so I was out in California with him, and he called a dinner meeting of all of us. And the oldest daughter was very political. The youngest one wasn't so much, but the oldest was a reporter for the Fresno Bee, and she and I were very close. And so she says to me, I think this is going to be his retirement announcement. And I said, I've not heard anything. And now we were very, very close, and I hadn't heard a thing. So we were talking about it. And so we go to their house for dinner. And so we have dinner, nothing said, nothing at all. We have dinner and so forth, and we leave the table and we go into the living room. And he's in there, and we're talking, and Mrs. Sisk cleans up the table, I guess, and the daughters were helping. And then she comes in, and she sits beside him, and he said, well, I wanted to call all of you together to tell you that Mom and I have decided that I will retire at the end of this term. And this is confidential, because I intend to announce it at the Kiwanis Club, which he was a Kiwanian, then at the Kiwanis Club next week, and I will announce it there. But if the word gets out, Tony, and Bobby was his daughter, Tony and Bobby, she's a reporter, so she had a scoop, right?
Right.
So he said, if this gets out, Tony or Bobby, I can change my mind, and I will. So needless to say, we weren't about to say anything anyway, right? So that's how I got into it. He openly supported me, and I didn't have a problem getting elected the whole time I was in Congress.
After being elected to Congress, you made disability a priority.
Right.
What is it about Tony Coelho, not necessarily the politician, but the person that enabled you to work in a bipartisan fashion to help craft this piece of legislation, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990?
Well, I think one of the things that's important that a lot of people don't really know about me, but I'm very religious. And I have real strong religious values about what should and should not happen, and particularly the treatment of people less fortunate than me and so forth. And that's people of color, sexual differences, disability, and so forth. And so when I got elected, I was committed to these values. And what I tried to do was offer amendments in regards to the whole disability area, because we weren't covered. And so I realized after offering these amendments that we didn't have our basic civil rights, so it didn't do any good to do what I was trying to get done. And so I then started looking as, well, how do I get our basic civil rights? And of course, Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65 tell you a lot what they went through. And so I looked at that, talked to a lot of people, and realized the only thing to do was to do something in regards to civil rights for those of us with disabilities. And Reagan was president. He had a team, a group that dealt with, it was the Disability Committee. And it's the President's Committee on Disability and so forth. And the chair of that was a woman from Connecticut. Vice chair was a woman from was from Colorado. And both of them had children with a disability. Neither one of them had a disability. And they were asking for something in the area of correcting civil rights. And so I started talking to them. I didn't realize at the time there was a major grassroots effort started out in California of trying to get something done in this area. But I worked with the Reagan folks, and one of the things that I decided that I wanted to be bicameral, I mean House and Senate, and I wanted to be bipartisan, Republican, Democrat. And so there was a senator from Connecticut, Lowell Weicker, that had a son with a disability, and they were very interested, Republican, they were very interested in having him lead the effort on the Senate side, and I would put in the bill on the House side. And so after working on this and we got it together, I then sent out a Dear Colleague letter to my colleagues saying I was putting in this legislation. You know, what was surprising, Abe, is that members, Democrats and Republicans, would come up to me and say, Tony, I like what you're trying to do. I don't like the way my wife, my daughter, my son, my father, my mother, my next door neighbor is treated because of their disability. Mm-hmm. And I want to help you. Now, none of them have really read my letter or whatever. They just didn't like the discrimination. And so I got something like 50 some co-sponsors, bipartisan, but it was towards the end of the session. And consequently, we had to come back the next year and start all over again. And when I when we came back and I introduced it with another Dear Colleague, I got something like 150 co-sponsors. Then I left the Congress and I asked Denny Hoyer to lead the effort. I still would lead it from the outside and so forth. And the leadership was basically opposed because they felt it was too broad and that the public would end up being against it. And so they'd have to repeal it or whatever. We had just gone through that on some on another piece of legislation dealing with healthcare. And so the speaker asked me to pull the bill and to come up with different parts. And I said no. Now, at that point, I was the whip in the House. And so I felt I had authority. And I felt that we could get the votes to do it. So I said no. And then what they did is they assigned it to, I think, you know, 5, 6, 7 committees and about 12, 15 subcommittees in order to slow it down and stop it. Mm-hmm. But what we did was strategize and got the most favorable subcommittee of the most favorable committee. It was a gentleman from New York. He was very supportive of what I was trying to do. And so we had a hearing there, won it, and then the full committee supported it. Then we went to the next committee, did a subcommittee, subcommittee approved it. And the things was that relationships that I had developed really came into play. John Dingell was concerned about the scope of the bill, blah, blah, blah. But he and I were close friends, and so he said, I'll go along with it, even though I'm concerned. Jack Brooks from Texas was chairman of Judiciary. John was chairman of Health and Services, or what, I can't remember the proper title. Mm-hmm. But it was, I can't remember the title, but it was one of the most powerful committees. And Jack Brooke was head of Judiciary. Same issue, but I'll go along with you. Then we got to Public Works, and Greyhound decided to really take it on. And they organized the motor bus owners to take it on. And I got the chamber to be for it. And but in the Public Works Committee, we wanted on a vote of 21 to 20. And I could give you some of the stories about what happened, but that would take too long here. Mm-hmm. But that's how we got it. On the Senate side, it was fairly easy. You had Bob Dole, a person with a disability. You had Tom Harkin, brother with a disability. You had Ted Kennedy with several family members, including his son, with a disability. And you had Orrin Hatch, who was Mormon, and the Mormons, according to Orrin, felt that if you had a disability, you were a child of God. And so he was very supportive when I testified on the Senate side, actually had tears based on my story and so forth. So on the Senate side, we had two Democrats, two Republicans, and all of them with influential positions. So it got through the Senate fairly easy. The House was the side was the problem. And then when we had to go to Papa Bush to sign it, and I'm talking about President Bush. I was very close to him, so I do call him Papa Bush all the time. His chief of staff, John Sununu, was totally opposed because the impact it would have on business and this was going to be awful and so forth. And John personally told me, he said, I'm recommending a veto. And I know you're going to talk to the president and he might overrule it, but you just know that I'm pushing for a veto. But I talked to the president and he said to me, he said, look, I am supportive of what you're trying to do. John has his right to have his view and he'll present it to me and so forth. But I'm with you because what people don't know is, or some do, of course, but that he had a daughter who died of a disability at a very young age. And so he and his wife were committed to disability rights and so forth. So that was, we got it through over John's objections and we got it in. And it was a great day when he signed the legislation.
The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, or ADA, is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on disability. As the primary author of this piece of legislation, Tony, how do you view the last 30 plus years when it comes to the goals set out for the ADA, and have they been met?
Well, I would, you know, look at, there was no data to support what I was trying to do. In other words, what I'm saying, we didn't know how many people with disabilities there were in the United States. We had no idea where they were and so forth. So definition of what is a disability had to be defined by agencies, government. So there was a whole period of taking this piece of legislation and how do you implement it? And they really didn't at the end of the Papa Bush administration. And so it became an issue for Bill Clinton, and he was very, very supportive as well. And he had people in the Justice Department, which this is went to, who were aggressively trying to help get it implemented. And we made some progress in that period, but then it slowed down because there wasn't the priority. W. Bush, the son, as president, of course, had the sister who died, and it was opposed strongly by Dick Cheney, the VP. What we did is that the Supreme Court ruled that ADA only covered physical disabilities, and that was, you know, they were all older, different generations, and that's what they saw, but that's what they ruled, and I was irritated as heck because, you know, I helped draft the thing, and I talked openly about disability and other disabilities. I talked openly about epilepsy, I'm sorry, and other disabilities. And yet the record showed it, but the Supreme Court ruled that those of us with these intellectual or other disabilities were not included. So we had to introduce legislation, and we called the Americans ADA Amendments Act. And we introduced it, quickly went through the Congress, basically overruling the Supreme Court, which is not normally done. And then it was on W's desk, and Cheney basically was opposed. So I'd heard that. So I went down to Houston and met with Papa Bush. So I'm explaining what's going on. He says, well, where is it locked up? And I said, well, and I started stuttering. And he said, no, tell me, where is it locked up? And I said, well, Mr. President, I only know what is being told to me. I don't know for sure, but I'm told it's in Cheney's office and he's the one who's holding it up. And he said some things, which I won't say on the air here. So he taps the phone and calls his assistant and says, get me the chief of staff, meaning W's chief of staff. So in a minute comes on and he says, hey, you know that ADA Amendments Act, it's there before the president. That's really important to me. It's the L word, and I really want him to go ahead and sign that. So he hangs up, and I'm sweating. I'm thinking, the L word, please, please, please. This is the W and Cheney administration. L means liberal. That's going to kill it. And so I was careful. He was telling me about, you know, what was being told him. And I swallowed a bit and said, Mr. President, what do you mean by the L word? And he said, legacy. I hate that word. That's what everybody says and so forth. And I don't want to say it because but that's what I meant. And I went, whoo. and of course, then it was signed by W. So we had Papa Bush sign the basic bill and W signed the Amendments Act. So both Bushes got involved. In that meantime, there was all kinds of attempts on our part to get it enforced. And that meant the Justice Department and so on. And it was Clinton we pushed. We didn't get much help in the W administration. We came on to Obama, and they aggressively pushed it, got the data that we needed, and enforced it. Now, I always say to people, look, all civil rights legislation is a piece of paper. There's nothing about it except it's a piece of paper. It has to be enforced. And if you don't have an enforcement mechanism, you have nothing. So whoever's the president of the United States appoints the attorney general, the attorney general appoints the head of the civil rights division. That's the key. If the head of the civil rights division doesn't want to enforce the civil rights bills for people of color, gays, women, or disability, nothing happens. The Obama administration really enforced it, making states comply, making companies to comply, and then, of course, taking action for individuals, not specific, but groups of individuals that were discriminated against. So we got really pushed and so forth. Now, I will tell you that during all this time, I have argued aggressively that I do not want the ADA opened up for amendments, because I've always felt that there would be a movement against the ADA and that we'd have trouble. Sure enough, when the Republicans gained control of the House a time before this, and they passed legislation by close margin. It was only a few votes. Passed legislation to basically gut the ADA. So my concern was verified then as a result of that. But it was killed in the Senate. And so now the ADA is stronger and stronger. I don't see a way for them to amend it or try to gut it. But who knows? Mm-hmm. And so has it been enforced to the extent that I'd like? No. Has it reached the accomplishments that I wanted? No. But I always tell those of us in the disability community, listen, in 64 and 65, civil rights for people of color was established. Do you think it's worked totally for them, that everything is great and so forth? The 70s, women got their basic rights, in effect, civil rights. And basically, you know, women still have problems and so forth. And I said, so it's a long process for us as well as others. So we got to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And if we do, we'll get there.
Tony, if we bring the conversation a little closer to home, so to speak, how can members of the University of Hartford family be better allies to people with disabilities, both on campus and in our local communities? And I guess more broadly, how can the average citizen affect change for people with disabilities?
Well, I think the key thing is to understand that those of us with disabilities have abilities. I like to say all the time, because of my epilepsy, I can't be a pilot on a plane. I can't drive an ambulance or a police car. I can't have a gun. You know what? I don't have trouble with that. There are a lot of things I can do better than people who don't have a disability. And so it's making sure that you give people with disabilities an opportunity to fail. If you give us the opportunity to fail, then we can prove that we can succeed. But if we don't have that opportunity, we can't get anywhere. So for companies, for individuals, give those us of with a disability an opportunity to fail. So I'm not asking for anything or demanding that anything be done other than just give us an opportunity. And what we have found is that a lot of businesses that who have hired people with disabilities realize many things. One, that those of us with disabilities want a job. Those of us with disabilities will be there on time because it is so critical to us. You know, if you don't have a job, you basically can't rent or buy a home. You can't get a car. You can't take care of your family like others can do. So it's critical that we have a job, that we have income. I told basically five of the last six presidents that I don't know any group in society other than those of us with disabilities who want to pay taxes. And the reason we want to pay taxes is because that means we have a job. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's fighting not to pay taxes. We're the other way around. And so what can companies do? Hire us. What can individuals do? Promote us, help us. We don't want a handout. We don't want sympathy. What we want is opportunity. And if we can't do it, fire us. If we can't do it, say no. But be open as individuals or companies or societies, churches, give us an opportunity to fail.
Tony, on behalf of the University of Hartford and the Disabilities Affinity Network, I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Abe.
This interview is sponsored by the University of Hartford Disability Affinity Network. The NAI network is open to all University of Hartford employees and serves as a part of the university's strategic efforts to ensure an inclusive environment where employees experience a greater sense of belonging and engagement. If you are interested in learning more about the Disability Affinity Network or other UHART employee affinity networks, you can find more information on the University of Hartford's Diversity and Inclusion main website. I'm Abe Hefter.